14, Acts 14th chapter. I'm glad to be back. Thankful for Justin's pitching in for me. I know he did an outstanding job. He's a good Bible student, so appreciate him helping out while I was away. We have this lesson today and then chapter 15, the bulk of chapter 15 this Wednesday night, the Lord willing, and then we have the last class a week from today, which is the fourth of our four extra reviews, and then the quarter's over, so then you'll be ready to go. I think the next quarter begins on a Wednesday night, a week from this Wednesday, if that's correct, the 21st, correct? All right. So you'll be good to go. All right, let's begin. We haven't done this in a while. Let's review our 17 Bible periods. Again, I think this is good. I wouldn't suggest doing this every time, but we never want to lose sight of the big picture. So periodically, I would just suggest that you do this with your students. And again, these you can mix up like we mixed up the Acts facts in previous classes. You can sort of make a game out of it. So since I'm mic'd up, I'm not going to talk because all you'd hear would be me on the recording. So I want you all to say them, and I know you know them. So let's go. Number one. And which one are we in right now? Of course, we're in the early church, which is the story of Acts. That's where we have been this quarter. The children and I are finishing up the life of Christ, the third quarter of that new curriculum. So they'll start this with you next quarter. All right, really good. Now let's go over our Acts facts, and we're going to complete this whole column on the left side of the screen. So today we have 14 chapters. So, and they're in order. They're not mixed up. So, chapter 1, chapter 2, Pentecost, Peter's preaching. Chapter 3, lay man and lesson. Chapter 4, restraint, release, and request. Chapter 5, deception and detention, the story of Ananias and Sapphira and the apostles being detained. All the apostles, not just Peter and John. Chapter 6, the servants are selected. Chapter 7, Stephen was stoned. Chapter 8, Samaritan salvation. The gospel finally went outside of Jerusalem. Chapter 9, Saul saved and Dorcas delivered from death. Chapter 10, Cornelius was converted. Chapter 11, it's three words. Report. No, I'm sorry. That's not three words. So that was a trick. Well, and's not a word. The ampersand's not a word. The next one's three words. Chapter 12. Persecution, Peter and pride. All right. I got confused there, which is not hard for me to do. Then chapter 13 and 14, these are the only ones that aren't alliterations in our list because we couldn't come up with a cute way to make the word start with the same letter. So it's just a reversal of each. Chapter 13 was where the journey started. Antioch. And which Antioch was it? Antioch of Syria to Iconium. That's what Justin covered this past Wednesday night, and then today is the reverse, was Iconium back to Antioch of Syria. So that's the first 14 chapters. Really good. All right, chapter 14 now. I want to start with this map, and this is just a cutout of a, you can get several maps you can find for your classes as well, of the first journey. And I just want us to familiarize ourselves with the areas that we're going to look at. Keep in mind that, and I like this map because the different areas, as best as the artist could tell, they're colored to distinguish them. Of course, here is Antioch of Syria, where they're starting each journey. They started this journey, of course. Jerusalem is off the map to the south of Antioch. And again, as Justin covered, they've gone all the way to Antioch of Pisidia. That was chapter 13, where Paul and Barnabas spoke in the synagogue, and Paul reviewed another. That was the second of the two sort of Israelite history lessons that he gave in the book of Acts. And that took place, again, in chapter 13. But we're looking at these areas mainly. We're looking at Pamphylia, and that's Lycaonia, I think it's how you pronounce it. And, of course, Galatia's up here. So in the, and I think the Waldrons do a good job of explaining this in their book. I don't don't recall what page it's on, but they give a nice historical synopsis of why regions were called certain names when Rome sort of compressed their rule in this area. But we got Phrygia to the west, Lycaonia, Galatia, Pamphylia, Lycia will be in future journeys. Then, of course, the cities we're looking at in this lesson, let me erase these, will be, again, Antioch of Pisidia. We got Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. So later, when we look at the letter to the Galatians, which we won't in this quarter, but to whom was Paul writing? What churches were included in that? Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. They were considered in larger Galatia proper, but more specifically, they were in this area known as Lycaonia. So I just kind of wanted to get us our heads wrapped around exactly where we are. And again, we finished up last class in Antioch of Pisidia. So what we're doing is we're preaching through southern Asia Minor in these two chapters, chapter 13 and 14. And we've left Antioch of Pisidia, and now we're in Iconium, which again is in Lycaonia. So verses 1 through 6 deal with Paul and Barnabas and their labors in Iconium. So as this chapter begins, they continue their custom. When they went somewhere new, where did they go first? They would go to the synagogue. They would preach to the Jews first. And as Luke writes at the last of this verse, he says, a great multitude believed. So again, it wasn't a small number of converts. Whatever it was that they preached, whatever it was that they taught, there were Jews there who were willing to listen to the scripture being taught, the prophets, the prophecies, those things that have been mentioned earlier in Luke's record, and they believed. And no, not just the Jews, but Jews and Greeks, or Greek-speaking Jews, those who have been referred to in other chapters as the Hellenists. But there was another problem. There were unbelieving or disbelieving. I think some versions even say, do some versions say disobedient Jews? Or do all versions say disbelieving? Unbelieving or disbelieving or disobedient. They did not believe, and so they started. To me, this is ironic. Who did they side with? Gentiles. They normally wouldn't have anything to do with Gentiles. But they have a common enemy. And there's that old phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the disbelieving Jews who weren't persuaded by Paul and Barnabas' preaching, they sided with the Gentiles who weren't going to believe either. And they stirred up one another, especially the Jews stirred up the Gentiles, and that became a source of embitterment against the new believers. So now we have this friction that's occurring here in Iconium. But despite that, and I imagine you could almost feel the tension as they would work together, the Christians, here's the outside forces. Luke says that Paul and Barnabas did spend a long time there. And what was the reason that Luke gives for that? Why were they able to spend a long time there?
Relying
on God doing what? Signs and wonders. We've mentioned this before. They were able to continue working their signs and wonders, which tells us that God was approving of their labors and willing to work through them. And these other verses here, chapter 4, chapter 6, chapter 8, previous lessons we've looked at, especially chapter 4. Remember when the apostles were released from their detention and they came together and they had that prayer? Remember what their request was? They said, we want to be bold, but Lord, we request that you keep doing what? You keep working signs and wonders through us. That will embolden us and give us courage to know that we're doing the right thing here and that you're with us and behind us. And so here Luke writes that they kept relying on that. I know Paul wasn't and Barnabas wasn't there in that prayer in chapter 4, but they're apostles now. And it's the same concept. Again, chapter 6, when Stephen was preaching, they were impressed with what he was able to do. And they could not, Luke writes, they could not cope with the wisdom with which he spoke because he had God on his side. Chapter 8, Philip preaching in Samaria, they saw what he did and they were willing to listen to him. So here we have these two apostles. They are emboldened to keep doing what they've been doing. They're relying on God's strength and God's power as he worked through them doing these signs and wonders. That's how they're able to overcome this opposition. But Luke writes in verses 4 through 6, what about the city? What does he say happened? It was divided. A clear lines of demarcation. Either you were with the new believers or you were not. And so there was a division. And as we've seen in the past again, what happened with respect to Paul and Barnabas? They had to leave because why? Well, there was a threat. This is something that they've seen before. So again, you see there in verse 5, an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and these unbelieving Jews to not only mistreat them, but to stone them, to execute them. And it became aware, or Paul and Barnabas became aware of it in verse 6. So they leave Iconium, and they flee to, and look back on that map again that I showed earlier. They went to the other two cities in Lycaonia, which were Lystra and Derbe, so not far away. So now they're still staying in this district of Galatia. So now we're in Lystra, and this is the bulk of the chapter. What happens here in Lystra? Look at verse 7. How does Luke continue, or how does he begin this section? What they fled, just like the first Christians in chapter 8, but they kept doing what? They kept right on preaching. They didn't go into hiding. They kept right on working. Now specifically, he says in verse 8, something happened in Lystra. Who does Paul come in contact with? A lame man. We've seen this before, haven't we? How did Luke describe the lame man? From birth. So he's never walked. He's never taken a step in his life. And he's listening to Paul preach. You'll see there in verse 9. And there's something that Paul notices. Now, maybe you're thinking back about the lame man from chapter 3 when Peter was preaching. But there's a difference in how that scene was described versus how this one was described. How was this lame man different from the first lame man we studied? Yes, correct. This man had, it was evident he was believing. He had faith. Luke doesn't mention that about the lame man from chapter 3. He was begging for alms. He wanted something just for his daily needs. But he was listening to Paul preach, and Paul saw that he had faith, so then Paul just says what to him? This is verse 10. Stand upright on your feet. Now, you don't say that to a man who's never walked in his life. He's not able to do that. But what happens at the end of verse 10? Two things Luke mentions. Did he stand up? Mine says he leaped up, jumped up. I mean, he sprang up. And then what happened? He began to walk. Just instantaneously, that's what happened. All right? So I want to comment on this. I think this is a good teaching point we'll talk about at the end of class today. So he leaped up, he leapt off the ground, and he began to walk. That's through verse 10. Now, here's what happened when this miracle took place. It had this desired effect, because as we've seen with signs and wonders and miracles so far, when a sign or wonder, a miracle was performed, it was done to get their attention so they could see it happening. So that part's the same. But think about where we've been primarily up to this point. We have been closer and closer to Jerusalem, which you would have seen a larger Jewish population. All right? And I'm making this distinction for this reason. When you go back to these other places, chapter 3, chapter 5, chapter 8, and chapter 9, where miracles were performed, the desired effect was people saw it, and then it was almost like wow them for a moment, and then the miracle worker, either an apostle or someone on whom an apostle had laid his hands, would then start preaching. They would talk about some prophecies. They would talk about Jewish history, these kinds of things we've seen before. They weren't dealing with pagans, primarily. I'm speaking in general terms. But as the gospel has gone farther westward, and primarily, again, further away from a predominant Jewish influence. Now, there's obviously Jews here because we've already read about them, but it's not mainly Jews. So what kind of crowd are they going to run into, more or less? It's going to be more paganistic. And I'm making this distinction because what was the reaction when this took place? Did Paul start talking about prophecies? No. Why not? That wouldn't have meant anything to them. In fact, the crowd saw the miracle, and they didn't say, well, we understand what this guy's got to say. No, what did they say? The gods have come down to us. Entirely paganistic. So that's what now they're dealing with on this occasion. That's in verse Verse 11. When the multitude saw what Paul had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down to us." They even named Paul and Barnabas, didn't they? What was Barnabas' name? Zeus, the chief of the gods. And they gave Paul the name Hermes because he was the spokesman. And Hermes must have been the main spokesman of the gods in their minds. Not only that, but then someone else comes in the picture. In verse 13, what happens? The priest of Zeus, so he would have been Barnabas' priest. He comes, his temple's just outside the city, Luke writes. And what does he bring? He brings garland, some kind of, whatever that represents, some trappings for the service, if you will, a sacrifice. And he brings oxen, doesn't he? Brought oxen and garlands to the gates, and they're prepared to do what? Let's offer sacrifice to the gods right now. So that's what Paul and Barnabas are dealing with. All this happened, it seemed to me, rather fast and furious. So now they have this issue to deal with. So look at how Paul and Barnabas deal with this, verses 14 through 17. And Gary, if you'll read for us, please, those verses 14 through 17. And then we'll talk about them some.
But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, "Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness."
All right, thank you. Now, while we're here, Kevin, if you'll turn to Exodus 20 and read that verse just in a moment, and Justin, if you'll turn to the 19th Psalm, we'll have these verses read just in a few moments. So, let's look at how Paul and Barnabas dealt with this. Their initial reaction was to do what? They tore their clothes, which again was a sign of grief, remorse, anxiousness, if you will. We don't approve of this. This isn't a good thing that's happening. So they do that initially. And then they try persuading the people. And their first line of argumentation was what? What's the first thing they said? "Listen, we're just like you. We're not divine, we're not deity, we're just men, just like you. So we're not deserving of this praise or this worship." And again, have we seen an apostle refuse worship already in Acts? Who was it? Peter. What did Cornelius do? He fell down on his feet in worship. And Peter said, "No, we're not having any of that." So the apostles were always aware of their humanity, if you will, and they would not ever receive any worship. Then they say in verse 15, after they say that we're men just like you, "We preach the gospel to you in order that," what needs to happen? That you people do what? You turn from these vain things. What are these vain things they're referencing? This idolatry. Yes, don't worship these vain, non-existent gods, but you turn rather to the living God. Now look carefully. Excuse me. They don't portray God as the God of the covenant, do they, in this preaching? Again, why not? These were pagans. These were Gentiles. So maybe here's a lesson that when we're doing any kind of teaching, whether it's formal preaching in an assembly, or we're having a one-on-one Bible study with someone, or a group study. And again, I think the Waldrons make this point in their book. Know your audience, know who you're talking to, and start from where they are. And you'll have more success that way. And so they do. They talk about not God of the covenant, the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but God as what? Creator. And does that fit these people? Weren't they made in the image of God? All men are made in the image of God. Now, I had Kevin turn to the Exodus. I believe he's quoting Exodus 20 here. Back in the book of Exodus, which again was the giving of the Ten Commandments, which would have been to the Jews as a covenant. But when Moses wrote that commandment, Exodus 20, verse 11. Let's read that verse for us, Kevin.
"For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it."
Now, they're talking about keeping the Sabbath day, which was a Jewish idea. But how did Moses phrase it there? He talked about God in what capacity? As creator. And this text, I believe, Paul is at least referencing that. Maybe he's even quoting it. That God is creator. So that's why you should turn from these vain things to serve the one who made you. And he also says in verse 16, what has God given to all men? This is the next to last bullet point there. They have free will. All men have free will. He says, this is a God in generations gone by. He permitted all the nations to go their own ways. You are free to choose and do whatever you want. That's mentioned here. But this concludes now in verse 17. You can choose to go your own way. But has God left evidence? Has God left himself evidence that he's worthy to be worshipped? Yes. And what evidence is mentioned here in this short little speech? Yes. I'm going to call it natural evidence. You know, we have historical evidence, but this is natural evidence. But again, would pertain to these people. Things like what does he mention? Rains. Fruitful seasons. Filling your hearts with food and gladness. Now, Justin, read for us the 19th Psalm, verse 1. All right. Look outside the window, any of us, if you're an unbeliever, and explain to someone how all this came to be if there's not a God. Because it's just too complex, it's too intricate with detail to have just happened. And so Paul says, look, you're free to choose what you want to do, free to go your own way, but the God who made you, the Creator who wants you to turn to Him from these vain things, He left you plenty of evidence to believe. Just look out here and see. And there's a rhyme and a reason for that. Now that's in just real succinct form. That's the argument that Paul and Barnabas made to refuse this worship that they're not going to take on the part of these Lycaonians here in Lystra. So that was what they said. Now, were they successful in this? Scarcely. Look at verse 18. My version says, and even saying these things, they with difficulty restrained the crowds from offering sacrifice to them. So it wasn't easy, but it seems that they, I mean, Luke doesn't say they didn't do it. He just says with difficulty they did it. So these people were bent. They were determined to worship these two sign workers, these two miracle workers, as the gods who had taken on human form. But Paul and Barnabas did restrain them. All right. Now, verses 19 through 20, at least the first part of verse 20. More opposition. Who are the opponents this time? Jews from what two places does he say? Antioch of Pisidia and Iconium. Now we just had been in Iconium. When they were in Antioch of Pisidia, and this is the lesson that Justin taught, what was the opposition back there? Did they have to leave that place? Remember they taught in the synagogue and then the whole city came together the next week. And the Jews were jealous, the text said. And so, again, Paul and Barnabas had to leave that place. So now they're in Lystra. And they come from, I believe Antioch would have been to the west of Lystra. And Iconium, they were just there. So they come back. They're chasing Paul and Barnabas everywhere they go. They were determined to just harass these servants of God all the time. So they went over the crowd, verse 19. Having won over the multitudes, what did they do? They stoned Paul. Stoned him. And did what with the body? Drug him outside of the city. Now, was Paul killed? The text doesn't say. He could have been. We don't know. Doesn't matter either way if he wasn't or not. But they supposed him to be dead. They just left the body. And so their job was done. They just left. What did Paul do? He got up. He stood up. And who was watching? Disciples. I'm going to make a comment in a future class, and some of you won't be in here because it's going to be in the second half. But part of this group, who remembers who was from Lystra? Timothy. And his mother and his grandmother. Now, I don't know at what point they obeyed the gospel. We don't know. I'm suggesting perhaps this group called the disciples who saw Paul get up, they could have been in that group. They could have been believers already, but we won't press the point. Anyway, the disciples who were there, they saw Paul get up, and what's Paul do? he goes right back into the city. I mean, talk about a determined disciple. I'm going right back in there. So he did. Yes, Tony.
And whether he had been dead or not, this was a miracle for him to be able.
Yes, because even if he wasn't dead, what happens when you're stoned to the, to your physical body? Well, yeah. I mean, I think the Walters make a point in their book that he could have been injured for weeks, but he just gets up and he goes right back into the city. I'm not, we have to be impressed. I've said this before. We have to be impressed with the apostles. We really do. They were just determined. Back when the council was telling Peter and John and them, you're going to quit this preaching? And they said, no, we're not stopping. Here Paul is stoned and drug out of the city, left for dead. He goes right back in there. We need to, they're not divine, they're not deity, but they were faithful to the charge they were given to continue the preaching the gospel. So they go back into the city, but then as this section concludes, you'll see there in verse 20 the next day, where does he and Barnabas go? They go to Derbe. Again, that's another city here in Lycaonia. So this section goes together, the last part of verse 20 through the first part of verse 21. The next day he went away with Barnabas to Derbe, and after they had preached the gospel to that city, that be Derbe, and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium. And so they're just making a backtrack. Now they've hit the end of the journey, and they're going to come back through where they had been to these cities in this region. And again, Luke just says, many disciples were made in Derbe. Many. Let's emphasize that. This isn't a small number. Now the trip back to Antioch of Syria begins, and they come to Antioch of Pisidia. And when they get to this place, I got six things here that they did. Look at the six things Paul and Barnabas did. The last word of verse 21, they come to Antioch of Pisidia. So look at the things in the order that they did. First thing they did was what? Verse 22. They strengthened the souls of the disciples. So here they come back through. How long has it been? We don't know, but it's not been that long. They come back through where they had planted this church, and they strengthened their souls through their preaching, their words of encouragement. Second thing they did was what? Now, I just said the word. They encouraged them to continue in the faith. Be faithful. Don't quit. Don't give up. Maybe even saying things like, look at us as examples, which Paul wrote that in the Corinthian letter, but, follow our example. You continue in the faith. Don't quit amidst all the harassment and the persecution that you'll face. Then what do they say next? All right. Numbers 3 and 4 sort of go together, or rather 4 and 5 do. Well, no, end of verse 22. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Through many tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. So they reminded them that you're going to have to endure hardships. They already have seen this. And perhaps when the apostles leave, I'm just speculating, but I don't think it's too far off the point. When they would leave through with their preaching, who will draw the ire of these opponents? Well, it'll be the believers. They'll have to face these threats. And so they remind them, to get inside God's kingdom, you're going to have to endure hardships. There's going to be tribulations. So they remind him of that, and we'll talk about that in just a few moments. Then these two go together. They also do what? They appointed elders in every church. And Luke writes, having prayed with fasting, maybe specifically for these appointed overseers, or maybe just they prayed for and prayed with the saints, generally speaking. We don't know, but they did that. And then the last thing they did, verse 23. They commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. So perhaps this last one goes in hand with some of these first two, strengthening their souls, encouraging them to be faithful. As we depart, we commend you to the God who saved you, to the word of his grace, to be faithful to him, those kinds of exhortations. That's the six things they did when they were here in Antioch of Pisidia. That's through verse 23. Now the journey will conclude here just in a moment, and they're going to keep passing through. Now they're traveling toward and arriving at the other Antioch, that's Antioch of Assyria. They go through Pisidia and into Pamphylia, so they're coming back further down toward the coast of the sea there. And they speak the word. You see there through verse 25. They get to Perga. They went down to Attalia, which was on the coast. And then what did they do when they get to Attalia? They catch a ship and go back where? Antioch of Syria. So let's make sure that the children know the two the two different Antiochs here. Let's not get them, you know, get them confused. So Italia was in Pamphylia, and they go to Antioch of Syria, home base. Not just for this journey, but for all of Paul's travels. That will be where they launch from every time. So these 3 points as the chapter concludes. When they had, this was from where they had been commended. So they returned to where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had accomplished. That was the beginning of chapter 13 when they started this journey. What's the next thing they do when they get back to Antioch? Or rather, what's the first thing they do? They gather the church for what purpose? They're going to tell them, now here's what all we were involved in. Let us tell you what happened on this journey. We went here and did this. We went here and this happened, so forth and so on. And the Christians wanted to know. And of course, that's a good application. We'll talk about that just in a few moments. And Luke concludes this chapter with what, just a factual statement. They stayed there a long time. They worked with the church there at Antioch. And they would have been such a, I mean, imagine worshiping in a local church where an apostle in hearing him preach and teach and talk with him and hear him describe things that God did through him or them, if you will, that would have been just a source of huge, huge encouragement as a disciple of Jesus Christ. Okay, before we get to our teaching points, in the chapter 13 that Justin taught in this one today, one thing didn't happen in these two chapters that will come into play in future chapters in the book of Acts. What am I thinking about? There was no letter yet written. Not yet. So on the first journey, what I call as the journey, there's 6 journey epistles that we can plug into the book of Acts. None has happened on the first journey. That won't happen until the second journey. So no letters yet were written by an apostle. All right. Now let's look at some teaching points. Anybody have a comment or a question before we talk about these major lessons from the study today? Yes?
I don't know if there's a way to answer this. So I've never thought about this, but where it said that they were speaking in Lycaonian, so what, do we know what language they would have been speaking? Like, what were Paul and Barnabas speaking?
I don't know, and I think the Waldrons talk about that some in the book. I think I remember reading that, but there was a known dialect. It was somewhat ancient, I believe.
Greek was kind of universal.
Yes. Yes. I don't know. We can't say what they were speaking, but these were people who had sort of a, and I'm summarizing here with what I read from Bob Sanders' book, sort of an ancient heritage that was taken over when Rome reorganized that section of Asia Minor and it became known to be mainly Galatia. But this was an old dialect that they spoke, and so these were guys that were, I'm just going to say, they were holding on to an old language they used to speak as a different sort of people. And, I mean, obviously, Paul and Barnabas understood that through the help of God, I'm sure.
It's not necessarily pertinent to the story.
Yes. But again, go through the Waldron's book and read those comments Bob and Sandra make. I think they do talk about this just a little bit, kind of gives you a little bit of a background as to what was going on. That's a good observation. All right. Here's the teaching points that I thought of. Again, you may have different ones, others that you want to stress to your class. I do want to cover this because we looked at miracles already, but this came to my mind. The nature of biblical miracles is often misunderstood and misstated, even to this day. Now, what do I mean by this? Signs and wonders in the first century, we've seen that phrase several times through our study so far. They were a necessary ingredient for the early church to be successful. Because why? Well, Revelation wasn't complete yet. It was still ongoing. And until that finished, based on passages like 1 Corinthians 13, when the perfect came, then that which is part will be done away with, Paul writes. We had to have these to give emphasis and credence to the word that was being spoken. Now, even today, and we even have some children who are saying in Bible classes, well, they worked magic. I'll tell you, that's a cheap phrase. This isn't magic. This is real. Okay, look, let's not call it magic, because we've looked at magicians from Acts 8 and Acts 13. Simon was a sorcerer. And Elymas, again, the lesson that Justin taught, he was a magician. And those powers were shown to be fraudulent and fake when compared to a legitimate Bible miracle. So let's not let anyone call them, well, they worked magic. No, they didn't work magic. These were miracles. They were empowered by God by being able to work these signs and wonders. And to me, that's just a cheap description of what was going on. And even today's charlatans who get on TV and say, well, I'm a faith healer, so forth and so on. No, that's just equally dishonest. There's nothing to that. So let's be impressed when we read about a legitimate Bible miracle that was done at the hands of a Holy Spirit-led apostle or someone he had laid hands on. It's a miracle. It's true. It's legitimate. And it helped spread the gospel in the first century. So I wanted to throw that in. We've looked at miracles in the past already, but still, this miracle here in chapter 14 brought this comment to my mind, at least. So there's one suggestion for a teaching point. All right, second teaching point I came up with, but to serve God in His kingdom means to accept and endure hardships. Are we through having to go through tribulations and hardships? I wish we were, but we're not. All of us, either we haven't, or we have in the past, or if we have not, we are likely to have to endure hardships. How did Paul and Barnabas know this truth painfully? I mean, look what they just been through. Physically been mistreated numerous times. Jesus warned about this reality to his disciples. Matthew 10, I didn't come to bring peace, but I came to bring a sword. And who would be a man's foes? Those of his own household. Someone accepts the gospel, someone does not. There's going to be a natural division right there. You don't have to create it. It's just going to happen. He talked about that. If the world hated me first, what did Jesus say? It's going to hate you too. So he talked about all that. And then also the inspired writers later in the New Testament, Paul would say, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. Talked about that. So that's a reality. And here we saw this come to play here in our lesson today. So I think you can emphasize that. Here's the third teaching point, and to me this is crucial. We have authority established for local church organization. What do I mean by that? Well, again, Acts 14, verse 23. What's one of the things they did when they got back to Antioch of Pisidia? They appointed elders in every church. All right. We have New Testament texts, and we can look at these. 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1, 1 Peter 5, that do explicitly talk about and discuss the qualification for a bishop and the work of a bishop. You can turn in and you can read those. But what we don't have in the New Testament, we do not have a text that provides a command from God on how many bishops per church. You don't have it. It's just not there. So how many overseers does the church need to have? Can one serve as a bishop by himself? No. How do we know that? Because the only text we've got is an example. And that's this passage right here, Acts 14. An approved example. They appointed elders, plural. Isn't that what it says? Elders, plural, in every church, singular. That's how we know we have to have a plurality of bishops. Now, why am I saying this? Because I've heard brethren say, recently and in years past, well, we don't believe in this command and example and inference stuff anymore. That's just Church of Christ jargon. No, it's not. No, it's not. We have authority established on how many bishops you have to have in a local church. It's plural. Acts 14:23 is our authorized passage for that important activity. And in this application, the church gathered to hear this report. Saints are glad when men come in to give report. If we've had fellowship with these activities, overseas, somewhere else in the country, anywhere on the globe, and we've sent men out, we've helped send men out to preach the gospel, we want to hear about that work. And so we do that. Why? Because they did that here in the first century. That's why we do that. So you'll hear this passage, Acts 14 and verse 27, referenced a lot when we have that kind of activity. All right, so that's a good application for us to follow. All right, we'll go through chapter 15 this Wednesday night, and I believe we'll stop at verse 35, and that's the end of the quarter. Then our last class again next Sunday will be our fourth extra review class. So I appreciate your participation, your comments in class this morning.